Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour for January 24th, 2019. Wow, are there a lot of topics to cover tonight? And I saw the blood moon, the wolf moon, as they call it. Saw it myself for the total eclipse. And anyway, very interesting. But here's a story that just came in. And thanks, by the way, for listeners. I, you know, a lot of topics, I don't have time to go all over the news, see everything. So people see things, send them in, always do that. And that's really great. Appreciate that. But this story, while the blood moon was going on, and just to explain, the blood moon, it's not that there is something going on the moon. It's just simply the way the light comes around Earth. It refracts around Earth. And the reddish light is what hits the moon, and the ultraviolet light and the higher frequency light just go by the moon. And so there's an abundance, let's say, an overabundance of red light that is hitting the moon, causing it to look red. And so therefore they call it red moon. And it happens during these total eclipses. But anyway, during the eclipse, somebody was taking footage with a video or a camera or something, and they caught what they say is an object hitting the moon. And it's a little bright spot on the side of the moon. But let's look at the logic here. If this had been a meteor, some kind of object that hit the moon and sprayed material up into the air. Now, this is over on the left limb of the moon, and all of that region is blocked from light. So why would something which is just like a dust column, allegedly, look white? It would look the same color as the moon. You wouldn't ever really see it. So I don't agree with the interpretation that this was a meteor that hit the moon. I believe more correct that a better answer would be that this was an electrical discharge like a lightning bolt, but the moon doesn't have an atmosphere. So, and this is something I've talked about all along, is that the moon is like Earth in a sense. It's out there in the solar wind, and the discharge of the solar capacitor is going on, although it's much broader than this little speck. But that is a different interpretation, and what really happened is probably impossible to say. It'd be interesting to go there if we could pinpoint this location on the moon, and we probably could with fairly good accuracy given the picture and the location on the moon and everything. We could probably go with equipment someday, and this would be a great assignment for kids. Remember this when you get older, you're in a space program, you're going up around to explore the moon and say, hey, let's go see what that object was during this January 21st, 2019 blood red moon and this little light flash. But if it were an electrical discharge, then in that area you would see little balls of glass, little spherical balls of glass. And the reason they're spherical is because without atmosphere, the molten glass just pulls itself into a little ball, and then it, when it cools down, it would form a ball. And they find these on Mars. They call them blueberries because they're about the size of a blueberry. They're little balls of glass, and it's due to electrical discharging, and Mars had significant electrical discharging. It was observed by the ancients when Venus the comet came by. But back to the blood red moon and the alleged asteroid that hit the moon, you understand that if a column of dust blew up out of the moon, and along that surface, there's the only light there is the light that is coming from the little bit of light that's shining on the moon. And there's no reason for a vertical column of dust to become illuminated more than the moon itself. And so that explanation does not make sense, if you understand. Now, other plumes that have been discovered, like on Io, they discovered a volcanic plume. And it was discovered by a woman who was working for NASA, and her job was to sit there and look at the pictures of the Io and other objects that were being photographed by the Voyager spacecraft. And she noticed a little plume and said, "Hey, look, everybody." And so she was credited with the discovery of the first volcano, active volcano in the solar system. But it was visible because you were looking at it from the side. And clearly there were many other volcanoes going on Io. There had to be many pictures of active volcanoes, but you couldn't see them because you had to be looking up along the rim. But the situation with this lunar explosive event is that there's no reason for it to be brighter than the surrounding lunar surface. Okay, so I'll leave it at that. But very interesting, a lot of news coverage for this blood red moon. And by the way, there are, I know sheriffs actually talk about this, they get ready for the full moon. All kinds of strange events happen during the full moon, and it's really true also during the new moon because of the electrical conditions. It's the human body, basically, and your brain and your nervous system are electrical antennas. So they are connected into this lunar electrical situation when we are aligned with the moon, and thus has something to do with the human psyche. Okay. I just want to announce that I don't know if anybody else has actually breached this topic, and this is regarding the 9/11 disaster in New York City, the Twin Towers coming down. There are people that propound the demolition theory, and you can see the puffs of smoke coming out the side of the building as that building comes down. But there's more going on there than meets the eye. And so my theory now is that, and like I say, there might be other people that have proposed similar ideas, but there was more than one type of explosive event going on there to bring those buildings down. It clearly was not due to jet planes colliding with it. That is just baloney. That is just ludicrous to imagine that somehow. And then, of course, Building 7, which nothing hit it at all, and we know that the owner said pull the plug and or whatever, pull the building and have it demolished. So the Building 7, which was not hit by airplanes or anything, was demolished with explosives. So we know that the other buildings also had to have demolition. But when you look at that building turn into powder, there's something else going on. And after the California fires, this is the point, when you see cars burnt in the street to nothing, and right next to them a plastic garbage can and trees that are not affected, it's like, holy cow. You know, this was done with very precision-directed energy from above. And so remember also that in the Bush 1 administration, back in the late 1980s, they tried to take down the Twin Tower also, and they tried to use strap bombs, the same method that they took out the Oklahoma City building in Oklahoma City, the federal building. They used strap bombs down in the basement, and you could see the pictures where the pillars that held up the federal building, the Muir building in Oklahoma City, you could see where those pillars had been taken out at the base, down underground, and they tried to do that with the Twin Towers back in the Bush 1 administration, and remember, it didn't work. They didn't bring the buildings down, so I think on the 9/11 one, where Bush Jr. was prez at the time, they weren't going to take a chance with only one method of bringing that building down. They were going to have possibly two or three methods. So that building, both buildings, were hit with multiple devastating explosive events, any one of which could have taken them down. So, as I said, logically, they weren't going to take a chance on just one method, because the structure of those buildings was incredible. And plus, when you see those buildings go up into powder, I mean, literally the cement in those buildings and the steel structures vaporize, turn into powder, and then come raining down. You could see the powder just coming out into the street. And there again, that's similar to a demolition, where the structure, as it crumbles, that cement turns into a fine powder. But if you've seen other demolitions, there's a lot of fine powder involved. But with the Twin Towers, if you look, there's a lot of fine powder coming out the very top of the building. So anyway, all I'm saying is that I believe, in a sense, it really doesn't matter how they took the buildings down. The question is, who did it and why, and how come there's never been a true investigation? But anyway, my belief is that there were multiple methods used to take down those buildings. Okay, just a quick, this is interesting. They put out a chart of the non-essential workers in the various agencies of the federal government, and NASA tops the list of percentage of employees that are non-essential at 98%. So NASA, number one in non-essential employees during the government shutdown. Okay, on to the next topic. China just extended a new policy regarding solar, the input of solar, and they said what they've done is they've set a price, and they will buy solar panels if the price meets their price structure. They're not just going to pay whatever the market will is presenting to them. But basically, the solar companies, the companies that manufacture solar panels, are in a world of hurt now, because China was the biggest consumer of solar panels. All of the European and the U.S. companies, in addition to Chinese companies, were selling to the Chinese government, which was installing these vast arrays of solar panels. And as I announced on this show last March or April, I believe, China put out a moratorium on any new solar panels. And of course, the reason they did that is China was the biggest installation country as far as solar panels is concerned. And they realized that you could not shut down and bring online nuclear or coal or natural gas-fired power plants. You could not bring them online or shut them down on a moment's notice, depending on the whims of sun and clouds and solar panels. And so they realized that for all of their investment, it cost more money to shut down and bring online their standard centralized power plants. And of course, they learned the hard way. I told everybody this was going to happen in my 2009 book, The McCanny Wing Generator World Energy Project, in which I have a chapter. It's called The Myth of Alternative Energy. And so anyway, the end result is that China now is buying solar panels, but at their price. And I made this example. I've talked about this on the air, etc. Is if you took solar panels, this is an imaginary solar panel, you made it 100% efficient. In other words, it converted 100% of the sunlight to electricity. And I think they're down around 30% now. They're about 30% efficient. That's when they're new. But imagine you could build a solar panel that was 100% efficient and could charge a penny for that solar panel. That would be the retail price. It still would not be a viable alternative to the central power company. In fact, because the simple reason that on maximum, on a good location with good sun, you're going to get a maximum of 4 solar hours per day. In other words, 100% output for 4 hours on average per day. And that just, it's horrific, because the other 20 hours of the day, that means you would have to store up energy from your solar panels and then reap the energy, bring that back from the storage device, whatever that is. Lithium-ion batteries are very expensive, or batteries on the scale necessary to power a city, for example. It's just, it's out of this world expensive. And additionally, now, if you have an array of solar panels that's enough to run your grid, okay, now to store up energy to run the other 5/6 of the time, in other words, those other 20 hours of the day, you would have to put 7 times the amount of solar panels in one part to run it during the time when the sun is out and you're running your network directly off solar panels. And the other ones are to store up energy so that you can then run off batteries the rest of the day. Well, when you, like I say, if you take a solar panel, 100% efficient, one penny a piece, it doesn't work. It, even at that outrageous, something that nobody will ever achieve, you still will not get a replacement for the electric central power company. And that's the point. Listener wrote in, and a very good question. Can the wing generator, can the Mekani wing generator replace the 3-blade wind generators on the tower? In other words, use all the same gearing and electronics and everything, just replace the 3 blades with the wing generator? And the answer is, like many answers, it's yes and no. I mean, you could do this, but there are many, many problems with this. First of all, the wing is much more efficient, and so on for the strength of the tower and everything else, on one of the towers that they're running, say 1.5 megawatt tower with a 3-blade wind turbine, the wing could literally run something about 20 times that, or about 30 megawatts. And so to replace the 3 blades, which are like maybe 300 feet long each, or 300 feet in diameter, the whole system, the wing would be about a tenth that size to deliver the same amount of power. And additionally, I don't use high RPM transmissions, and the current 3-blade wind generators have transmissions which translate between low RPM, where the 3 blades are trying to turn around, and then the generators are high RPM. And so that is a terrible mismatch, and any engineer who knows anything about transmissions will tell you you can go from high RPMs down to low RPMs very easily, but you cannot go from low RPMs, especially in a high power situation, up to high RPM, because the slightest little defect in balance, or say the bearings start to wear and that shaft starts to wiggle a little bit at the high RPM end, doesn't work. That thing is going to come apart. You're going to have shafts flying through the side of the housing, and that thing is going to burn up real soon. And so that's the problem with the 3-blade wind generator design. And I've bypassed all of that. So the end result is the part is that is salvageable to use the wing generator is the wiring infrastructure and the towers and very little else. Actually, very little else is salvageable from the 3-blade wind turbines, and it would be a mess. It would be a giant mess. So I'm not sure. It's a good question. It's something that would be a good option because all of that infrastructure is already there. But they have terrible designs, the GE, the Siemens, the Vesta, the transmissions. I know people that recondition the transmissions on these, and That's the main component that goes out. Also, the hub, everything is way overbuilt for the wing generator, the hub, the bearings, etc. Because the wing generator is very gentle. It doesn't weigh much. The three blades on a three-blade wind turbine weigh upwards of maybe 150 tons. And the wing is extremely lightweight. It's like featherweight compared to that. So all of this massive structure to hold up these three blades is way overbuilt for a wing. So anyway, there's really, it would be nice, but there are so many bad design features in the three-blade wind turbines that they're really, for all practical purposes, not salvageable. Just a quick note here. I got an email from my good friend Jackie Patru. She's a lady, I believe she lives out east there, and I used to be on her radio show quite a bit, and she's retired from the radio talk show business, but is still very active in sending out information helpful to the public. And one of the emails I got recently from Jackie is talked about SIDS and a very unfortunate case where little kids are being killed by vaccinations. And the medical industry writes it off as what they call SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. In other words, when a baby goes in, gets shots, and dies from the shots or malpractice, they just call it SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. And they just write it off. They don't investigate, they don't do anything, and that eases the medical profession from any responsibility for basically killing little kids with vaccinations. So, and then I went around and I scoured other people that I know who are in the medical industry, and I got a lot of interesting answers, but mainly the people that I know are very much against vaccinations. And if you stand your ground, there's more and more people coming out. The governments who are basically controlled by the pharmaceutical companies are trying to force mandatory vaccinations on all levels of people. They're trying to get everybody to get their flu shot. And there again, I'll tell you, I talked about this before, a flu shot is the most ridiculous thing in the world. Because what they do is they take last year's strain of flu, which has nothing to do with this year's strain of flu. They give you the flu virus from before. And most people that take the flu shot, not I won't say most, but a good percentage of them get sick from the shot. And so anyway, your body is designed to withstand viruses, to identify them. And if you have a healthy immune system, you are going to be just fine. Here is a story that I don't think you're going to see too many other places, but there's a guy, a joker, let me start out by calling him that. His name is Tony James, and he wants to do the following. Take higher education and finance it, what they call, through an income share agreement. And this is mainly the way I conjure this up, the way I understand it, that this is mainly targeting lower income people, primarily minorities, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, other people that may have a bit more difficult time getting money to go to higher education. And so what they want to do is make a deal with the colleges and have the colleges basically selling this, so that you would go, say you want to sign up for a college, and say you don't have much money, so you're trying to get into the college financial aid office. And so what they do is they come out with this, and this is being sold by Blackstone Financial and Lehman Brothers. So this is what the college would do. They'd say, well, look, we got this program where you can sign up and promise a portion of your income until someday in the far distant future you pay off this loan. And they have all kinds of provisions like, well, if you don't make much money, you only pay a certain percentage, and therefore it's a good deal. So you get your higher education. But here's the problem. It's collusion between financial institutions and colleges. And I'll tell you, let me take you back about 35 years or more, possibly about 40 years. And the colleges began to realize that mom and dad, now this is at the era like when I was a kid, my parents didn't have much money. I went to school because I got a full scholarship in physics, mathematics, because I was a good student. And then because of the matching grant program that was started by John Kennedy, I got a grant that paid for my room and board. So my entire 4 years of college at a private school was paid because of scholarship and matching grant. And then all I had to do was earn my spending money, money to buy books, etc. But all I had to do was go to school. I lived on campus in the dormitory. All the food was there. I could go over to the physics building. I had my office in the physics building. And so life was good. But then at that point, and I'll tell you what, at that point, my college tuition per year was $1,200. Now, that's an incredibly low price for college when people start thinking about what college costs today. But at any rate, what the colleges learned is because in that era, people started paying off their houses, and they realized that by the time kids got to college, mom and dad had already paid off and they had a good chunk of equity in the house. And so their mom and dad were getting ready to retire. The kids were going off to school. And so what they put the burden on the parents and they raised the prices to exorbitant amounts of money for college education. And so like when I was at Cornell, those students were paying like 60 grand a year for tuition. Oh my goodness, you know, and I'll be honest with you, Cornell was not that very good education for undergraduates. It was difficult, but it really wasn't, it was more like mass production education. At any rate, that's just a little side note, but this idea of financing education through private banking and investment entities, this brings us back to something that used to exist. It's called the company store. There's a song that is about this. A guy named Tennessee Ernie Ford used to sing this song. He had a very deep voice when I was growing up as a kid. And it went like this. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. And the idea here is that the company store was on a farm or a ranch where they basically, and for all practical purposes, enslaved people, paid them a very low rate, and then they set up a store at the ranch, and this was done a lot down south. After slavery, it was just a new form of slavery. And also in the Middle Ages, it was called indentured servitude, where the people lived on the land of the wealthy, of the royalty, and they basically had to pay rent, and they never made enough money to earn so they could buy their own land. It was called indentured servitude, and that was actually outlawed, just like debtor's court was outlawed in the Middle Ages. And so now this person, Tony James, wants to bring this back and strap it on the back, pretending that he's helping these struggling college students. This is so sick. I mean, it's indentured servitude. It is the Middle Ages. And like I say, it's mainly targeting blacks and Hispanics and young kids with poor backgrounds that don't have a way to get money. Then they want to offset the federal programs that are student loan programs. And by the way, that's one of the biggest debts in the world in the federal budget is the student loans. So, and then also, let me just comment, there are people, politicians coming out of the woodwork now that want everybody to have free college education. Well, they've tried this in many places and it doesn't work. In other words, people would get paid to be students. And what happened, like in Denmark and some of the socialist countries, is they found out that people would be professional students. They'd get one degree, then they'd go to school and they'd get another degree. And then people would be 30, 35 years old, still profession. They were professional students. That's what happens when you pay for education, for higher education. And of course, students that go to public education up through high school don't make money off of it. But anyway, this idea of financial institutions, so-called taking up the slack for minorities, for poor kids, and then taking a percentage of their future and equity in their education, is a terribly bad idea. And also, the colleges can collude and actually raise the prices because they know that they're going to get paid right away from Lehman Brothers or Blackstone, and those probably are going in collusion. I bet you $1 million they're going to be in collusion with the government, saying, "Hey, if we go broke, the government's going to come in and bail us out, right?" So you can smell this coming. This is a rotten fish, man, coming all the way down the turnpike, and it's going to be in your front yard real soon. So watch out for something called education finance or income share agreements. Don't go near it with a 10-foot pole. Okay, just a quick comment. Now, I follow weather. I have been for years and years. I've followed the GOES sites, the government, the geo-orbit satellites. I have all my different methods of finding weather, solar weather, etc. A number of years ago, this started where they slowly are taking offline your access to good weather information. So they started taking down the solar observatories, and about 100 worldwide. You used to be able to go on the internet, get their data, look at their data, etc. No more. All of a sudden, the weather satellites, etc., very little data was allowed through to the public. And now, and by the way, the Weather Channel, weather, spaceweather.com, space.com, all of these are Rothschild-controlled disinformation outlets. And just recently, a site that I use just for, like, if I wanted to go, some outdoor activity, I would go to IntelliCast, because you could type in any little town in the world, and it would pull it up and give you a 10-day forecast, give you all the conditions of humidity and rain, potential rain or precipitation if it was snowing, or the temperature. They were very good about almost right on in temperature, wind, and you could structure the output based on the information you wanted to see. Well, they just went offline and went to Wonder Weather or whatever that is. Terrible, terrible, terrible reporting. They don't have any place in the world. I mean, you put in even big cities, you're lucky to get today's weather and just rudimentary information like temperature, humidity. They don't have good wind charts. What I'm telling you is weather reporting is horrific. It is terrible. And these agencies, what I don't know if they're agencies or companies, they're privately owned, just have terrible reporting. So your ability to see solar weather or space weather or other types of information or earth weather or weather where you are is it's just horrifically bad. And I don't know that we depended once again on the government to provide us with information for weather and satellites, etc. Terrible, absolutely terrible information that's being taken away from the public. So just be prepared for that little gem. Just a little bit of statistics here and statistical analysis and how to do studies. I found this. This was on CNN, the CIA Network News, or the Clinton News Network, whatever you want to call it. I call it Candy Nugget News. Also, that's my old name for the CNN after the George Bush administration bought it after the first Gulf War. the CIA went in and bought CNN, and it's been total disinformation ever since. People like Anderson Cooper and the whole laundry list of yo-yos over there. The CIA bought up all of the basically news media, and they have, Murdoch and those people. But anyway, I sometimes go to CNN just to see what kind of garbage they're trying to pawn off on the public. And this one caught my eye, where a new study allegedly is saying that that because of global climate change, of course, which is a myth they're trying to promote still, but because of global climate change, there will be more girls born than boys. And so some company or some group, whatever, made a study, and they said after Fukushima, after other disasters, they took some data, and it turned out that more boys were born than girls based on temperature profiles. And so if the temperature profile was warmer, there would be more boys. If there were temperature lowering, there would be more girls or something. And I thought, how absolutely absurd. This is not how you do studies. That I always call it the refrigerator analogy. And so here's what it would look like. Let's look at the price of refrigerators, whether it goes up or down during a certain period of time for our study, and relate that to the number of births of young boys versus young girls, and then make an empirical correlation saying that, oh, the price of refrigerators went up during this period, so therefore, if more boys were born, if the price of refrigerators go down, then more girls will be born. That makes about as much sense. And so, you know, statistically, whoever's doing this, and then for CNN to publish this, is just, you know, there again, fake news, and in the sense of representing this as some kind of scientific study, absolutely ludicrous. But okay, anyway, enough of this. There's just so many crazy stories this week. I wanted to get through these, but here's a story that's really cool. I love this. And I've been discussing this now with a listener in some emails. And I've seen this before, and in the course in my more than busy lifestyle, I don't get to really research all of these things. But the other day, I was researching how they made alabaster containers. Now, alabaster is it's basically a mineral. It's a hardened mineral. And they used these for like wine vases. They used these for flower vases. In ancient Egypt, alabaster was used for containing liquids and storing liquids, etc., food, other types of liquids. And so alabaster was kind of the stainless steel container of old. Stainless steel not interacting with whatever you put in it. So the question is, how did they make these alabaster containers? Because they are like a wine bottle in a sense, in that they are hollow, but they have a small neck on them where you would put a cork or some kind of a plug or a wax seal or whatever. So anyway, the question is, how did the ancients make alabaster containers? Along with this comes the question of how did the Egyptians build the Great Pyramids? And how did they take the rock, etc., and carve it? And then also the question in Egypt, where they have granite, extremely, extremely hard granite, and the beautiful, amazingly symmetrical, beautiful artwork that they accomplished with granite. And there was a video I saw, I don't have the reference with me right here, but I saw a gentleman talking. And he was with, I think he was with Nexus Magazine. And but anyway, it was a video where he was talking about this same issue. But the overall question is, how did they form, like we know how to, you know, sandstone would be easier, etc. But there's many places, megalithic sites, etc., where they have granite and they're shaped. And one of the questions was, how do they move these? Well, I saw one explanation of how they moved the big stones up for the pyramid by building ramps, but not only ramps. They built a kind of a cage of four pieces of, they're kind of semicircles, and they put them around. So they take the block of rock, basically. They put these four wooden kind of crate containers around them, strap them down, but they're circular. So when you get done, you basically have a drum, and you put the ropes around the outside of the drum, and you can pull this up a ramp. And they showed how 20 people could move a 2-ton block of rock up a ramp very easily. So that was very instructive. And of course, but the seemingly harder question is, how do they shape? And you go like to the Incas. I was just not too long ago down in Peru, and I was working, of course, and made the discovery of the Nazca lines. That paper is on my webpage dealing with the Nazca lines being interferometer antennas, fractal antennas. And that white paper is on my webpage. It can be ordered there individually or with libraries, etc. But there again, I was visiting the Inca ruins, and this amazing, these rocks, just absolutely huge. And they fit together. They have keys. They have unbelievable shapes. So how did they shape these so that you can't even get a razor edge between these? But anyway, something has been around for a long time. It's not new in the archaeological world. In fact, the paper, one of the papers that this person sent to me, is from the 1980s. So this has been around for quite a while. But back to the point of, how did they extract the material inside the vases of alabaster? And it turns out, and this is well known in amongst the ancients, and it's shown in hieroglyphics, in glyphs, etc. In the Egyptian glyphs, they're showing that they're using a plant. Now, there's a plant that you make a mixture of a liquid, and it softens rock. And so you put this on a rock, you let it sit there a little bit, and then you can chip away at the rock and remove rock, and it becomes liquid, and you can form it. And then when you remove the liquid, that rock becomes hard again. So it's a way of shaping rock almost like clay, and then the rock becomes hard again. But in the interim, you can remove a lot of rock by using this softening liquid made from plants. And so that's really, really interesting, because now, for example, you see these gouge marks. They're big gouge marks. For example, if you go to Easter Island, or you go to some of the locations still in Egypt where they have found big rocks still in the bedrock where they're carving them out, these big gouge areas. And how could they do that? What kind of instrument would do that? And it turns out that if you soften the rock, then you can use a relatively soft tool. And the other thing that I thought was interesting is, in their discoveries, in their work, what they discovered was that the Egyptian craftsmen who were making the pyramids were skilled craftsmen. They were not slaves. And this was a group of artisans, highly prized. So this image of groups of slaves in loincloths with somebody bullwhipping them is completely false. And let's just put it this way also, that these were not the ethnic groups that today are claiming that they were somehow slaves under Moses in Egypt. So that story, although the story of Moses is correct, it appears that somebody has been trying to adapt that story without real reason. And of course, the promoting the idea that there were slaves that built the pyramids, and this is, in if you look at any of the movies, that go back, the Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston or any of the other movies that are dealing with that period of time, Moses, the Ten Commandments, etc. The image is that these were slaves under the whip building the pyramids, and that simply was not the case. These were groups of artisans, highly skilled artisans, and was not the people that are claiming that today. But the bigger point here is that this is something that's been known about for a long time. And so when I started putting these pieces together, it's just something for your information that, once again, we're not taught history the way it really should be taught. Now, this brings up an interesting point. I had a big discussion with John Moore yesterday morning about education and how the history books teach totally, totally incorrect history. So the fact that the working of stone by the ancients was something that was well known, using liquids from a plant that softened the stone, where is that in the history books? I mean, that was back in the 1980s or before, long before that, when this was first recognized. And I don't know who the originator was, who the first person that noticed this was, but of course the ancients knew about this thousands of years ago. And so certainly something that's been lost, but why is this not taught in our schools? It would certainly clear up a lot of the mystery, and it would certainly get rid of these stories about the ancient pyramids in Egypt being built by slaves who were being whipped by the evil pharaoh. Nothing at all close to the truth. And by the way, now that we're talking about it, I saw this some time ago. It was a video about Easter Island. And according to the legends of the people that they encountered on Easter Island, basically, according to the legends, the question is, the Europeans discovered Easter Island, etc., and the big monolithic statues that cover the island looking out over the ocean. They asked, how did these get from the quarries where they could see some of them are still, they're left there partially carved in the quarry. But they asked, how did these get from the quarry to where they set them up at the location on near the coastline? And the answer was that they walk there. And so that's a very curious answer. You mean these stone figures walked from where they were in the quarry to near the coastline and stood there? And so anyway, the indigenous people showed how they did this. And this blew my mind. This was very interesting. So the base of these big statues, and by the way, if you haven't seen, when Thor Heyerdahl discovered these and did Aku Aku and talked about these, I read that when I was a kid. But they just assumed that what you saw above ground was the entire statue. So somewhat recently, they began digging down to see how far down these go in the ground. And they kept digging and digging and digging. And so these statues go way down in the ground. So the dirt that is there now on Easter Island is built up over who knows how many thousands and thousands of years. But anyway, back to the story of how these statues, these big rock statues, walked to the coastline from the quarries. And so they raised up with ropes. They raised up one of these big statues, and there was a road that they had actually, like a road that had been cleared, a path, you might call it. And with ropes connected up towards the top, there were four ropes going off to two to the front up on the sides and two to the back on the sides. And what they started doing is rocking this big vertical stone back and forth. And then by manipulating the cords, they got this big vertical rock, like 30 feet tall, weighing who knows how many tens of tons, to move, and it started walking. And they showed this stone walking down the road. It was absolutely incredible. So that's how the stones walked. And they did this with about 20 guys. And just by pulling on the rope, getting the rock to kind of teeter back and forth, and getting it to swing back and forth with the bottom swinging in one direction and then the other direction, they got this stone to walk down the road. And that's how they got them from the quarry down to the site. And so there are many, many places that, you know, clearly these people did not have big cranes, etc., to lift things. So then the question in many of the megalithic sites is, how did they lift these, like Stonehenge, how did they build that, etc.? How did they lift these massive rocks? And so there's still what I would say is mysteries involved in how the ancients did all of this, and more importantly, why did they do all of this? Nobody has really cracked the code at Stonehenge yet. I'm working on some concepts just from my own point of view as to what the different rock configurations were for. And if you remember, in my book, the Surviving Planet X Passage, it's a pamphlet that's a supplement to my book, Planet X, Comets and Earth Changes. But in there, I discuss how you take a pile of rocks and build a calendar and a clock. And it'll give you the four seasons, it'll tell you the calendar, it'll tell you the number of days in the year, etc. It's a very accurate calendar. And they started finding these all over the American Southwest, down in South America. And it seemed like that the people who were able to survive knew this process. It's something they could figure out or whatever. But anyway, I basically rediscovered this process. Take a pile of rocks and you make a calendar and a timepiece that works both for the daytime for the sun and the nighttime, and this resulted in my product that I sell. It's the Emergency Survival Recalendar Sun Star Clock, I call it. And so that's available on my webpage, but it takes the same technique and puts it into a form that anybody can use, and you can carry this with you. I always carry one with me, and it's extremely, extremely accurate. It works in the north or the southern hemisphere. It works day and night. And once you set it up, there's also a little calendar there where you can go into the future and into the past. And if there's a pole shift, you can rebuild the calendar to go far into the future, far into the past. You can predict the number of days in the quarter between solstices, etc. And you do this all in a matter of a day or two. Set it up and recalendar, that's called the Recalendar Sun Star Clock. And if we don't have a pole shift, then it gives you a beautiful structure to read the date and the time, etc., using the sun or using stars. And it, like I say, it works in the northern or the southern hemisphere. And so anyway, a lot of thought went into that product. It's available on my webpage. And it's amazingly low price. It's like $39.95. And it has all of our solar system information so that in case someday, you know, we have a pole shift, big disaster, catastrophe, and in 10,000 years, some civilization comes and digs up and finds one of these calendars, it'll tell them all the information about our civilization's calendar, what the Earth was like, the tilt of the Earth, the precession of the Earth, and on and on and on, and where we give them the ability to replace Earth in its orbit in the solar system as it is today, and know exactly our orbit, the spin rate of Earth, the precession, the North Star, everything. It'll tell everything and on this one little plaque. It's really pretty amazing. But at any rate, I just want to spend the last couple of minutes here talking about my new release. I have a new release coming out, new book. It's going to come out on February 13th. And this is going to be accompanied by a tremendous amount of supporting material. So I don't pre-announce topics or titles, but just be assured that this is going to be a very important book. And it's going to be really, it's going to be written for many levels. It could be read by a third grader, high school, college, university, graduate school, or a professional engineer or PhD in just about any field. So it's going to be fairly high level, and it's going to be written on many different levels. So people at different experience levels can get different information from the book, all of the information given at different levels. But at any rate, very important. And right now it's on sale, pre-sale on my webpage for $24.95. And the benefit of the purchasing it right now is, number one, you will get an email on the day of the release, February 13th, coming up here. You will get an email, and you'll be able to download the book and all the supporting information that day. If you wait, you will pay a higher price, and you are going to have to wait a bit to get the information to download, because just for us to catch up from sales, etc. So anyway, the benefit is a lower price and the fact that you'll get the release on the release day, February 13th, should be an incentive for quite a few people to buy the book. Now, you can go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and all of the information is there. And you can either buy the book directly, you can get it in a library, you can buy, you will get it free if you buy over $350 worth of any products on the webpage. Then you will be put on the mailing list and get it for free. So many different ways to obtain the new book that's going to be released on February 13th. And I just also want to mention that I'm very proud of this book. It's, as with all of my books, it takes an entirely new direction, but it's based on my previous work. And this work is what I would call monumental. I would say that this work is going to take the subject area and bring it to a new level that has never been seen before, and which will shake basically the many different areas of study. So that's about all I can say about that. But anyway, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and the very top listing there is dealing with the new release, and of course the sales page. Also, I encourage people to join the paid cast. $3.95 per month for an extra hour every week, deep dive into esoteric topics. That's also on my webpage. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.